supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The family of a woman slain by her husband in 2006 is on edge after the killer, a former Penn professor, was released yesterday. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, family and friends of Ellen Robb addressed reporters today outside the Upper Marion home where she was killed.
Gary Gregory, who is Ellen Robb's brother, stood in front of the house choking back tears.
It was about 10 years ago that I drove up here and saw the police tape. And I saw them put her lifeless body in the ambulance.
Gregory's talking about the death of his sister at the hands of Raphael Robb, a former economics professor who specialized in game theory. Robb first told police someone had broken into their home and killed his wife, but that story quickly fell apart, and he confessed to killing her with a metal chin-up bar.
She was a loving mother who stayed in a relationship, an abusive relationship, because she thought it was best for her daughter.
In a civil trial after Robb's criminal conviction, a jury found that he owes the family $128 million in damages. Raphael Robb, originally from Israel, served a full sentence of 10 years behind bars.
Robb's release is not the last chapter in this American tragedy. In fact, I think that it's safe to say that the court system has not seen the last of Raphael Robb.
Gregory says Robb lied under oath about his net assets and should be criminally prosecuted for that. After his sister's slaying, Gregory started a foundation to support victims of domestic violence. Neighbor and friend of the family, Luann Dubin, says Ellen Robb feared her husband.
And it wasn't until certain situations arrived that we were able to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. And it was ultimately too late.
It's unclear where Raphael Robb will be living. He has a legal right to reoccupy his former home, but Dubin and other neighbors say they would do everything they could to prevent that from happening. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie signs legislation adding 20 new judges to New Jersey courts. Christie says the additional judges are needed to support criminal justice reforms that took effect this month, requiring swift action in pretrial proceedings and bringing cases to trial sooner.
To fully address those reforms requires that we raise our judicial complement to 463 judges, which is accomplished under this new legislation to meet the needs expressed by municipalities, by counties, and by the administrative office of the courts.
The legislation allows the state's chief justice to decide where the new judges will go. 12 other judicial nominees are expected to be confirmed by the state Senate, bringing the number of superior court judges in the state to a record high. Governor Christie gives his final State of the State address tomorrow afternoon, and we'll provide analysis and insight on that speech during tomorrow's show. If you've bought a soda in Philadelphia recently, you probably paid more for it than you would have a week ago, thanks to the city's new tax on sweetened drinks that went into effect January 1st. WHYY's Katie Culinary looks at why, so far, consumers are bearing the full brunt of the tax.
Philadelphia's 1.5 cents per ounce tax on soda, iced teas, and other sugary drinks is levied on beverage distributors, the companies that sell drinks to retailers like restaurants, corner stores, and supermarkets. That includes major corporations like Coca-Cola, Sunny Delight, and Cisco, and independent business owners like Andy Pincus. Pincus runs Carbonator Rental Services, the company his dad started in 1955. He shows me around his warehouse in Southwest Philly. The air in here smells sweet. That's because Pincus sells the syrup that gets mixed with fizzy water in soda fountains.
Here's a five-gallon box of our private label cola, which we manufacture to taste as close to the national brands as possible.
Just one of these big boxes of syrup makes about 220-ounce cups of soda. Depending on whether it's his own label or a national brand like Coke, Pincus charges anywhere from $60 to $90 a box. But now, every time he sells one to a customer in Philadelphia, Pincus owes the city $57.60 in taxes.
We're not talking about a couple of bucks on a $60 item. We're talking about $57.60 on a $60 item. It's too big not to pass on.
He explains it this way. For every box of syrup Pincus sells, he says he makes between $3 and $18. Out of that, he has to pay his delivery truck drivers, buy gas for the truck, and other costs of doing business. So Pincus says he can't afford to absorb the tax himself. But some of his customers were not happy when they got their new bills last week.
They started yelling at my drivers as if they have something to do with it. With customers telling them, this isn't right. You know, as if we're making a mistake.
Others are simply passing the full cost of the tax along to their customers. Alan Janone runs a catering business and restaurant in Northeast Philly. Every month, he buys 8 of those big syrup boxes for his soda fountain. Now, those boxes will cost him more than $400 every month. Starting on Saturday, the price of a glass of soda at Janone's restaurant went up 30 cents to $2.95.
Because a 20-ounce glass, 20-ounce cost me 30 cents extra. I'm only charging what they're charging me.
Just a week into the new tax, many retailers throughout Philadelphia are doing the same thing. But that may not always be the case. In Berkeley, California, the only other city in America with a sweetened drinks tax, a study found consumers pay between 30 and 70% of the penny per ounce tax there, depending on the beverage.
I think after a while, things will shake out.
Stephen Balsam is a tax expert at Temple University. He thinks eventually distributors and retailers in Philadelphia will start to absorb some of the tax and lower their prices. He says it's economics 101. When stuff costs more, people buy less.
And when sales go down, the retailers, the wholesalers, they get more competitive. They don't like to lose the business. So they will absorb some of that.
To be clear, Philadelphia's new law doesn't require distributors to pass on the tax. But right now, distributors like Pincus insist they have no choice.
If any one of the distributors, and this is a very competitive industry, if any one of the distributors thought for one moment they can gain a competitive advantage by not passing the tax on, they do it. And that hasn't happened.
And he doesn't think it will anytime soon. In the meantime, the soda industry is fighting to overturn the tax in court. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Jeff Sessions is preparing to appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee tomorrow, the start of confirmation hearings in his quest to serve as U.S. Attorney General under Donald Trump. That service would not come at the pleasure of a collective of law school faculty opposing that nomination, among them Drexel Law Professor Richard Frankel. Professor Frankel, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
A pleasure to be here.
Yours is one of some 1,400 signatures on a letter going to the Senate Judiciary Committee heads. What's the gist of the letter?
The gist of the letter, as you said, is that more than 1,400 law professors who have expressed strong concern and opposition to Senator Sessions' nomination as Attorney General. They don't think that he will effectively represent the needs of a large swath of the American people.
Based on his
past actions as a senator, based on his actions as a U.S. attorney with issues related to racial justice, civil rights, immigration. He's taken some very extreme positions on a lot of these issues, and I think that will continue some of the divisiveness that was part of his presidential campaign.
Many of these issues are a matter of public record, whether it's his rejection for a federal judgeship in 1986 or his various stances on immigration, et cetera, et cetera. Is it that this body does not have the confidence that the Judiciary Committee members can debrief him sufficiently to make that determination? What is the intent of this letter?
I think one of the main intents of the letter was to tell the Senate and the public that he should not be Attorney General, that the Judiciary Committee should oppose him. You know, any senator should get the views of their constituents and other people in the country before making those decisions. And we think that as law professors, we have one specific perspective that we can offer. If he were confirmed, he would be the nation's chief law enforcement officer.
And so review for listeners what those primary duties entail.
He's responsible for, and I'm sure I'll miss a lot of them, but he's responsible for making big decisions about prosecuting cases, both criminally and civilly, similar to what he did as a U.S. attorney when he prosecuted cases that seemed to involve voter intimidation, attempts to intimidate African-American voters and try and disenfranchise black voters that led to his rejection, the Senate's rejection of him as a federal judge. He can be responsible for setting a lot of immigration policy. He has previously taken very, in my view, dangerous stances on immigration, such as,
for example,
supporting legislation that would it goes even beyond what the president-elect has stated, but that would say that non-citizens can be detained in prison without even a showing of probable cause. Right now, our policy, I think, when undocumented aliens, generally they're put into deportation proceedings. He would make being undocumented, or the bills he's supported would make being undocumented a criminal act, so that the policy would be to jail them before even deporting them, prosecute them and jail them.
Ultimately, though, it will take a simple majority in the Senate, 51, for him to pass that confirmation process. Realistically, do you think that he will indeed be our next U.S. Attorney General?
As history shows, most likely that seems to be what happens when the Republicans have the majority in the Senate, when they have the presidency, that chances are he would be confirmed. But that's not to say that it's a certainty. And I think if there are a few senators who recognize what I think are the dangers of Senator Sessions as Attorney General, perhaps they will reconsider.
If, for argument's sake, he does become Attorney General, these dangers that you describe, what subsequent checks and balances are in place to limit his activities?
Well, there's various bodies that could hold him accountable. Politically, Congress could hold hearings on actions that he's taken, like when Congress did that with Attorney General Holder with Fast and Furious program. If he enacts policies that violate the Constitution, I think you could bring him to court to challenge those, and a judge would make a determination.
Professor Frankel, thanks for taking us to school on this matter.
Thanks for having me.
Drexel Law Professor Richard Frankel, and you can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Latinos in states with exclusionary policies tend to have poorer mental health than those living in states with more inclusionary policies. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
The researchers considered 14 policies, including access to a driver's license and in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants, to create a policy climate index. By examining answers to questions about mental health from a national data set in relation to that index, researchers found that Latinos in Georgia and Arizona reported more days of sadness, depression, and anxiety than Latinos living in New Jersey or New Mexico.
A Latino person living in Georgia would have 14% more days of poor mental health than a Latino living in New Jersey.
That's Jennifer Hirsch, the senior investigator on the study and a professor of sociomedical sciences at Columbia. Hirsch says an undocumented immigrant in a state where it's hard to get a driver's license has to worry every time she gets in her car to drive. That can take a cumulative toll.
I've had people cry in my office.
That's Erica Almiron, executive director of Juntos, a Philadelphia-based immigrant advocacy group. She says Pennsylvania, which wasn't analyzed in this study, has had a tough policy climate for immigrants. As an example, Almiron says the children of a Philadelphia man, Javier Flores, who spent 16 months in detention but is now in sanctuary, have suffered mentally.
There's a post-traumatic stress disorder that happens to those children because when their father was picked up, they watched it. You know, he was picked out in front of his house with guns drawn on him.
Hirsch says future research could focus on whether a city declaring sanctuary status or similar steps could counteract exclusionary state policies. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
The story of Lizzie Borden has been summed up in this playground rhyme. Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. The case of Lizzie, accused, then acquitted of killing her parents with an axe in 1892, is complicated and has never been fully resolved. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that she's now the subject of a rock musical.
125 years after the famously grisly double murder, there is still lively debate in some circles about whether Lizzie Borden was the one who drove a hatchet into her stepmother's head 18 times and then did the same to her father 11 times. Already been an opera, and now Lizzie, the rock musical, having its local premiere at Christ Church Neighborhood House in Philadelphia this week, leaves no doubt that she did it. Director Kate Galvin says the story suggests that the crime arose from a domestic situation that was both bizarre and abusive.
If you're going to get inside the head of someone who commits a violent crime, then I think that the rock musical element of it is a great way to tap into that energy and that angst.
After a flawed police investigation and a questionable trial, Lizzie Borden was acquitted of the murder, but no one else was ever arrested for the crime. Galvin says this musical allows audiences to empathize with a killer who lashed out at her abuser.
So it adds some shades of gray to a story that I think a lot of us, you know, my impression of it prior to all the research that I did was, oh, this is a story about a rich woman who got off because she was rich. And that's not necessarily true.
The costumes are period appropriate, 1892, but with a modern edge. The corsets and petticoats have a steampunk aesthetic to give them a more rock and roll feel. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In the new year, let's go looking for planets with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, the inventory is growing by leaps and bounds, and now we're at the point where we can specifically try to look for planets of interest.
Indeed, we are now focusing our studies a little bit more specifically, shall we say. What NASA is now planning for is a new mission, a new spacecraft that probably will launch later this year, whose objective is to look for exoplanets orbiting nearby stars. Now, if we connect this with what we've spoken about before, about identifying possible Earth-like planets orbiting a nearby star, Proxima Centauri, then what we're now thinking more about is, can we identify planets orbiting nearby stars, thereby increasing the possibility that we might communicate or maybe at some point in the distant future actually travel to in one way or another?
Though the one thing we know that we will always have in common with whatever civilizations are otherwise out there is that we all obey the speed limit, which is the speed of information, which is the speed of light.
Yes, that's true. So no matter what we do, we'll still have that hurdle to overcome, no matter how close the object is. Because if we look at the closest star, it's a little over 4 light years away. That's the closest star we know of. Because we have such incredibly tortoise-like speed of traversing our region of known space, we're easily talking hundreds, if not thousands of years to be able to reach some of these other locations.
That turtle-like speed is sufficient, though, for exploring our own solar system. What can we look forward to in 2017?
Well, some of the really cool stuff that's going to be happening in 2017 involves the commercial space industry. And as we've learned from the past, the folks that are working in commercial space, like Virgin Galactic and SpaceX and Blue Origin, have done a lot in the last year to advance their cause forward. Some have had some setbacks. Virgin Galactic had a setback a year and a half ago that has really pushed them back a little bit, but they're still plunging forward. I think probably the biggest leader of the year is looking as if it's going to be the operation run by Jeff Bezos of Amazon called Blue Origin. Last year, Blue Origin had 5 successful vertical takeoffs and landings from a ground-based location reaching space as we know it. And if we think about that accomplishment relative to some of the other work that's been done, well, we find that perhaps Blue Origin has been a sleeper, in a sense. We've heard an awful lot about how SpaceX has been launching spacecraft and then returning the boosters back to the landing spot, the landing craft, out in the Atlantic Ocean. Well, if you think about what Blue Origin has done, 5 launches and return to the landing site on land, you might even say that's more advanced than what SpaceX has been doing. So in the coming year, what Blue Origin plans is to actually have a crewed mission in which the same spacecraft, not the exact same one, but a similar one, would carry astronauts aloft just up to the boundary of space and then have that spacecraft return safely.
Which is the more daunting task, the launch or the safe return?
Well, that's a great question. It's a huge risk either way. You're sitting atop a controlled explosion that's going to carry you up to altitude, and that controlled explosion is going to make sure that you do a soft landing when you return. I'm not sure we can split out which is more dangerous. I think the risk that's involved is tremendous on both sides.
Safe to say, happy comings and goings to you and yours for 2017.
Thank you, and same to you, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, time up without a...
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Without a space, Wave Incorporated.